The Monocle Quality of Life Conference returns, and this time we're touching down in Zurich. Join Monocle's editors and a lineup of tack-sharp panellists for lively debate, informed conversation and top-notch hospitality from the 28th to the 30th of June. Find out more and book your ticket now at conference.monocle.com. Welcome to Monocle 24's The Urbanist, the show all about the cities we live in. I'm Tom Edwards. Coming up on the programme.
When we spent a lot of time building and massaging the form, it seemed to work much better. So apart from the fact that we do believe that beauty is its own entity that's very important for humanity, it also works.
This week, we look ahead to the Venice Biennale and meet the man responsible for Austria's pavilion, Stefan Sagmeister. Then we're in Groningen to hear how this bicycle haven plans to become even better for cyclists and pedestrians alike. Plus, we get a sneak peek at the School of Cities, opening its doors in Toronto over the summer. That's all coming up over the next 30 minutes right here on The Urbanist with me, Tom Edwards. So welcome to this week's episode of The Urbanist. As the sun starts to shine, all eyes are set on the Venice Architecture Biennale, kicking off later this month. For its 16th edition, the exhibition has asked countries to explore the theme of free space in each pavilion. The Austrians tasked the celebrated graphic designer Stefan Sagmeister of Sagmeister & Walsh with the challenge of representing their country. Our design editor, Nolan Giles, caught up with Sagmeister at Belgium's And Festival in Leuven to talk about architecture, beauty and more.
We are now standing at Museum M in Leuven. It is a gorgeous, wonderful mid-spring day. People are in a fairly good mood because I think it was pretty crappy here for a long time. So now everybody is out in their first T-shirts with pretty shining faces to be seen.
And you get the sense that this is a city kind of moving forward. Obviously, this event is aimed at progressing the dialogue about design and creativity. But what's the vibe in the city for you?
Well, I love to come to places like this. This is my first time in Leuven. I've never been here before. But I've been to places like it. Small European towns in the world of 100,000, 200,000 people that make the impression for being eminently livable. It has a fairly gorgeous, partly medieval town center. There is a large university here, so there's a ton of young people around. Everybody is out and about in the cafes. It seems livable in the best sense of the word. And I think that, you know, having lived in the US for so long, these kind of places don't really exist there. If you want cultural offerings, you really need to live in one of the 10 big cities in the US. Below that, you might get a mall and a Cineplex, but not much more. And so, even though I've lived now for most of my life in New York City, I can also see that this is a great alternative.
Often, the challenge that architects have is they want to design something that's big and grand and useful, but a lot of the time, ego can come into the equation and it becomes about them and not about the context. From a design perspective, how do you do that without the ego? What is a great, grand design or architectural statement that is egoless?
I'm not even sure if I would look at architecture that way. Let's take a concrete example. Like, say, a piece of architecture that I think works really well is the Elbphilharmonie Herzog & Demeron in Hamburg. Now, is that egoless? No. But they're probably, my guess would be, and I don't know Jacques Herzog, but my guess would be that there was quite a bit of ego involved in it. It must have been very challenging to get that through the city. It was an incredibly challenging construction phase with people suing each other left and right, going over budget, missing many deadlines, as far as I know, not really the fault of the architects, but there was all sorts of problems that large projects tend to have when they need hundreds and hundreds of people to actually make them. And the reason why I think it's a wonderful building is, for once, it's beautiful. And it found this beauty in a contemporary way, meaning it's beautiful in a way that makes sense in 2018 or 2017 when it was finalized. It doesn't really hark back too much into the past. Second is that it's successful for a very wide range of people. I've seen busloads of German seniors there standing in line to get up on the viewing platform. I've seen cheapy souvenir shops selling already examples, like little souvenirs of it. So going much beyond the world of contemporary architecture or people who would be interested in that. I think that it speaks to people that have no education in that world because its form is strong enough to transcend a particular kind of educated group.
So it has mass appeal.
It has mass appeal and it's a good piece. And I think that that's the essence. Now, was there ego involved from the side of the architects? I guess, but that wouldn't really be the question that I would ask.
With Venice, Free Space is the name. What was the brief that you were given?
Well, that basically was the brief. Free Space. Meaning, you know, there's some wordings around it, but ultimately it was the brief. And we chose to interpret this brief very literally by basically creating a free space. Like we do know, like we're working in the Austrian Pavilion, we've been to the Biennale many times, we know the situation there. By the time that a regular visitor arrives at the Austrian Pavilion, they've probably seen a dozen to 20 other pavilions first, simply how it geographically lives. So we're very aware of that and wanted to create a piece that gives the visitor some free space because you've probably already overloaded with other things that having been seen and wanted to combine that also with a free space for ourselves, meaning that we can ultimately do whatever we want in a space like this. And so, of course, we worked on something that we are interested in, which really is beauty. And considering that we've been to a number of architectural biennials in Venice where the term beauty was not mentioned once, it's just not really on the forefront of architecture right now, we felt, let's definitely bring that in. So within that free space, we are talking about beauty.
And how do you translate beauty? What's your idea of beauty?
Well, if I would have to define it, which I'm not that interested in it, but ultimately I think beauty is a combination of things like composition, structure, form, material, and color that basically delight the senses, mostly the sight. And going out from that fairly dense definition, I would say we realized in our work in the studio that whenever we really took form seriously, when we spent a lot of time building and massaging the form, it seemed to work much better. So apart from the fact that we do believe that beauty is its own entity that's very important for humanity, it also works. Like there is actually a very big functional aspect to it that beautiful things just seem to work much better. They seem to live much longer. Beautiful buildings tend to be renovated much longer. They are basically no really ugly old buildings. They've gone to pieces because nobody wanted to renovate them. The stuff that we see from the past and why the past often looks so good to us is because the best of it, the most beautiful of it, was worthwhile preserving. It still exists. So from a pure, I would say, sustainability point of view, beauty is a fantastic strategy. Fantastic if you really want your piece to stay on long. And that's true for architecture, but it's true for simple things like bags. I have a bag that I've been using for over 30 years, and the only reason that I've been doing so and haven't replaced it with a different one is because it's still the most beautiful one that I've ever had.
And that's something that we actually talk about at the office because sometimes, you know, someone in a city will say, let's just paint these buildings in Islam a beautiful color, and immediately everyone's mind will change where that is not the reality. So how did you kind of interpret that in this specific project?
Well, I was last year on sabbatical and spent the first third of it in Mexico City, and therefore sort of like started as a little pilot project with a good number of friends and a good number of new friends, a tryout thing in Mexico City where we said, let's see if we can get some people together from the world of politics, from the world of art, from the world of organizations, and see if they can work together and basically beautify the city. And in Mexico City, it was surprisingly doable. Very soon after founding the whole little group, we already painted a skyscraper, and I was just on the phone with the person who runs it now, now found a couple of brands to sponsor some things. And I think that this fits because of financial constraints. Of course, painting seems to work the best because you can make the biggest difference with the least amount of money. It's literally as simple as that. And I would agree with you, just painting something colorful will not bring all the benefits, not at all. It's possibly a right step in the right direction. You know, ultimately, I think that when we talk about beauty, we really mean formal intent. And we're very aware that the vast majority of everything that's ugly in the world is not ugly because somebody wanted to make it ugly. We like ugly things, actually, like made ugly things. They are ugly because somebody didn't give a shit. And so much of that ugliness, that's not just true for Mexico City, that's true even for the outskirts of a small town here. It's pretty much true anywhere in the world. These non-spaces that nobody really designed or cared for. Somebody needed something, didn't really care what it looked like, as long as it did that thing that they needed it to do. And I think even a coat of red paint done with love and care might be the step in the right direction there.
That was the graphic designer Stefan Sagmeister of Sagmeister & Walsh in conversation with Monocle's design editor Nolan Giles. Groningen, the northern capital of the Netherlands, is one of the few cities in the world able to boast that nearly 2 in 3 journeys there are done by bike. It's long been considered a model cycle city due to a radical urban planning shift in the 1970s that sidelined 4 wheels in favour of 2. But as the city grew, things slipped, and the city's now on a major drive to improve things, not just for cyclists, but for everyone. Monocle's Amsterdam correspondent Venetia Rainey headed north to report.
It's a typically cloudy Monday in Groningen, and I'm cycling around the city with Alfred Casimir, the municipality's director for urban planning. He's showing me one of the city's new smart routes, practically intersection-free, dedicated cycle paths that carry around 20,000 people a day to Groningen University's bustling Zernike campus.
There you go, underneath the ring road. There's a cycle tunnel.
Okay.
And here we go underneath the railway. As you can see, there are no cars allowed here, just cycles.
It's just one of many measures the city is taking to make things better for cyclists. Some of the more obvious steps include more bike racks and cyclist-friendly roundabouts, but there are also more radical ideas, like giving half of a major ring road to bicycles and using innovative traffic systems to reduce accidents. But as we stop for a break, Casimir reveals the city's biggest secret for staying cycle-friendly as its population grows: compactness.
We didn't go into new housing programs in the sprawl, but we tried to densify it within a 30-minute cycling distance. Cycling is in our DNA.
And it's not just about bicycles. Casimir and his team also want to make things better for pedestrians and bus users. Anything that will encourage less people to come into the city by car.
By foot and by bicycle, and also public transport is very important. So it's like a chain of mobility. And if you come from further away, you can either bike there or drop your car at the park and ride and take the public transport.
This has led to some bold changes. Bus routes have been altered. Roads have been ripped up to make more space for bikes and pedestrians. Car parking spaces are disappearing. It's a boon for everyone on 2 feet or 2 wheels. But what about businesses who rely on vehicular access?
Well, if they could organize it better, I guess. And we get also a lot of stuff delivered, and there are rules for that, because in the morning lorries can go here in the street, in Zwanenstraat, but till 11, 12 o'clock. And if they are after that time, then they can get a ticket for it. So in the morning we get a lot of deliveries here, and in the afternoon they can't come here.
Marika Smit is an employee at Kaskop, a local cheese and delicatessen store. She says that overall the changes are positive, On her shop street, for example, bicycles used to be banned. Now they mingle with pedestrians, which has turned out to be great for business.
Well, we see that because you can cycle here, a lot of clients, customers, see our shop by cycling and, oh, there's a cheese shop and walking. People are different people than the cycling people.
So it works pretty well, actually, to have those two modes of transport.
Yeah.
In a 50-year-old sweet shop elsewhere in Groningen called Droppie, owner Christa is busy filling up bags of traditional licorice sweets, known in Dutch as drop.
The black licorice, I think 200 types, and then old Dutch candy, also 200 types, so 400 in total.
Her shop street has changed recently too, from a major traffic-clogged thoroughfare to pedestrians and cyclists only. She says it's led to a noticeable uptick in customers, and it's much more relaxed.
Yes, because customers can just slowly walk and look in the windows, and then it's not so dangerous anymore now because the sidewalks were very small. And then two buses and bikes and cars, so it was chaos. Yeah, it really was.
When it comes to logistics, however, vehicles remain unavoidable for many businesses, something city officials are hoping to change by promoting cargo bikes and creating distribution hubs to pool deliveries more efficiently. It's all part of their aim for a zero-emission city centre by 2025. For Groningen's City Hall, it's all about improving quality of life, as Vice Mayor for Transport Paul de Roeg explains.
So that really demands from us as a city government to make some very clear choices in the inner city, and I hope that these choices will make sure that we are one of the most livable cities that there is in Europe and maybe in the world, so people will come here with a good feeling and like to stay here as well.
Other cities take note. A bit of ambition and determination go a long way. For Monocle in Groningen, I'm Venetia Rainey.
A report there by Venetia Rainey in Groningen. You're listening to The Urbanist. Toronto has a rich history of urban discourse. It's here that Jane Jacobs wrote some of her potent work and launched some of her most successful campaigns in the second half of the 20th century. On the 1st of July, that tradition of urban debate will have something of an official forum for the first time. The School of Cities will open its doors at the University of Toronto, providing a focus to the ongoing conversation around urbanism. Monocle's bureau chief in Toronto, Thomas Lewis, spoke to the university's president, Merrick Gertler, on what the School of Cities hopes to achieve.
So the School of Cities is a new creation, and it's meant to bring together more than 200 faculty members across the university and our three campuses who work on various different aspects of cities. You know, we've got architects and designers, we've got urban planners, we've got civil engineers, but we also have economists and business school profs who work on this. We have people in public health and in environmental science and more. And the idea is to create a kind of interdisciplinary platform to bring people together across disciplines to work on the biggest issues and the biggest challenges that face cities, which really demand that kind of interdisciplinary collaboration. So we thought this is the perfect place and the perfect time to do it.
And some of those challenges that these very prominent figures from a huge range of areas will discuss, what are some of those issues that were discussed in the sort of planning process for the school?
Well, I think the top issues that would come to mind for most urbanists would be things like affordable housing. Successful cities like Toronto tend to be expensive cities, and we see that pattern around the world. And so you don't want to kill the goose that lays the golden egg. You want to make sure that many different kinds of people doing many different kinds of work and earning many different levels of income are able to afford to live and work and have fun in cities like this one and others around the world. Secondly, transportation, perennial challenge. What is the right mix between public and private? The interesting and looming questions around the role of autonomous vehicles in cities, which we know is coming. In our particular case, I think, you know, Toronto stopped investing in public transit for about 30 years and is now scrambling to catch up. So our school will play a really critical role in helping to inform decisions about where those investments should be, what kinds of investments they should be, what kind of service is required, and how do you make sure you reach all parts of the region and service those neighborhoods that are particularly underserved at the moment. Another pressing area would be in the realm of environment. Canada has committed to the Paris Accord and to the ambitious goals associated with that. Our ability to meet those targets is going to be made or broken in cities. And we hope that a place like Toronto will play a leading role in enabling Canada to meet its Paris Accord commitments.
And you say a place like Toronto. Toronto, I suppose, is in a very interesting position in that it's one of the most quickly developing big cities in North America. But it's also one of the youngest, I suppose. So in terms of elements of city life being up for grabs, that feels to me at least as being an incredibly potent part of a city like Toronto. It also has a very rich history of urban thought and urban debate. Mm-hmm. This is Jane Jacobs' town, of course, for intents and purposes. Mm-hmm. Why is Toronto, in your view, with a project like the School of Cities, such an appropriate home for an initiative like this?
So it's appropriate on so many levels. As you say, this is a city that has been home to leading thinkers, and Jane Jacobs is obviously one of the most prominent and really influential figures in the realm of city building and city making. And she was active here not just as a thinker and a writer, but as an activist. You know, it was her activism that really helped to preserve some of Toronto's most cherished neighborhoods during the 1960s and 70s when there was a huge push to build expressways. We've seen that movie in a lot of different cities. So she had a huge influence here, but of course her work has been influential around the world. We have people at the university like Richard Florida, who are extremely well known around the world, in Richard's case for his work on the creative class and the way that they have shaped the way cities evolve and change over time. The other reason why Toronto is such an interesting place to do this is because, you know, in a region of about 6 million people, more than half of the people who live here were born outside of Canada. That's a staggeringly high number. And they come from all over the place. So it's been this really fascinating and largely successful social experiment. It has produced unbelievable cultural life and vitality. And that's one of the drawing cards that has continued to attract talent from around the world to this place. So the question is, how do we make sure that continues to be true in the future? I think a lot of people see Toronto being really at a bit of a turning point right now, where it could go up or it could go down. So how do we make sure that Toronto continues to be a welcoming place for such a diverse range of people, that they all live together happily and harmoniously, and that continues to be as vibrant and as successful socially and economically as it is today?
I just wanted to go back to this idea of sort of working together in very broad terms in a city like Toronto. It seems that civil society, that kind of grassroots movements, really have a very rich history here and are very incredibly strong, maybe stronger than in equivalent cities, say North America or elsewhere. From your point of view, how well do all those components, or how well have they worked kind of historically? Is it a sort of a happy family here historically, do you think? And is there an element of bridging those gaps at the School of Cities?
Yeah, I would say we've had our ups and downs. And I think we've come through a period where institutions like this one, the University of Toronto, even though we've been doing a lot of research and teaching on cities, haven't done as good a job as we ought to have done to make that expertise available to partners in the community around us, whether they be in our own backyard or around the world. So one of the points of this exercise is to make that a lot easier. We really want to make the boundary of the university much more porous and break it down so that we welcome people to come into the university and tap into our evidence and our expertise and make use of our facilities and our spaces in the pursuit of this goal of making Toronto a better place. At the same time, you know, I think it's also fair to say that partners, say, in the public sector haven't been as open to or interested in collaborating with institutions like us. That's changed very recently, and I'll give you two examples. First of all, we just recently signed a memorandum of understanding with the City of Toronto, which enshrines and formalizes cooperation between U of T and the city to share data, to share expertise. We'd love to have more of our students working as interns in City Hall, for example. And there are many, many departments of city government that would love to be able to tap into the facilities and the expertise of the university. So we now have a framework for doing that. Another example is the cooperation that we've been brokering with other universities in this city. There are three others. We came together, I invited my counterparts at those other institutions to dinner and said, look, we compete on many levels, but we also face a lot of the same challenges by virtue of where we are. So why don't we work together and see what we can do to move the needle on things like affordable housing for students and we're improving the daily travel experience of our students. You know, between the four universities here, we enroll 180,000 students. And so we've been really successful in that regard in creating really the world's first comprehensive survey of daily travel experiences for university students. We're now making that data available to the Toronto Transportation Commission and to the regional transportation authority called Metrolinx. And they're able to use that now to refine their service offerings and the kinds of fare discounts, for example, that they might want to put on the table to make their services more attractive to students. Turns out that students represent more than 10% of the client base of an agency like Metrolinx. That's a big number, and that really got their attention. So that gives you an example of the great things that can happen when you do make that boundary more porous.
You talked earlier about Toronto being at something of a tipping point. In terms of the atmosphere in the city, the types of conversations happening on the campuses here, but also more broadly, would you say that there's an excitement to the notion of tipping over, or are there still kind of lots of unknowns from poorer urban decisions that have been made, maybe not in the too distant past? Mm-hmm. Would you say it's sort of more an exciting or a sort of nerve-wracking time broadly?
Yeah, it's a really frothy time. It's great to see urban issues being debated and discussed as much as they are right now. I think, you know, the future is still to be determined, obviously. Like a lot of cities, Toronto has got very strong neighborhoods where longstanding residents have resisted change, particularly change that would imply higher densities nearby, more people moving into their neighborhoods, more stress on services and these kinds of things. And yet we know that global cities are defined by density, and there are all kinds of good things associated with density. So this is a city that's still grappling with, how do you become comfortable with density? How do you learn to love intensification and urban development? And how do you do it well? We've got a lot of opportunity to do it well. And I hope that our school will be centrally involved in those discussions to raise the comfort level and help people see a path to how you do that well.
Merrick Gertler, president of the University of Toronto, speaking to Monocle's Thomas Lewis about the new School of Cities, which will open on July the 1st. And that's all for this week's episode of The Urbanist. The programme was produced by Carlotta Ribello and edited by David Stevens. To play you out of this episode of The Urbanist, here's Queen with Bicycle Race. Thanks for listening, city lovers.
I want to ride my bicycle. I want to ride my bike. I want to ride my bicycle. I want to ride it where I like. You say black, I say white. You say bar, I say bite. You say shark, I say him. And George was never my scene, and I don't like Star Wars. You say Rose, I say Royce. You say God. Give me a choice. Say Lord. I say Christ. I don't believe in Peter Pan, Frankenstein, or Superman. Oh,